Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
How does a country succumb to authoritarian rule? How does that happen? Well, sometimes it does begin with tanks and violence and a coup, as happened in Iraq with the Ba'athist takeover in 1968. That was the same year Abdul Razak al-Sayyidi was born. He grew up in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and he remembers how, over the years, the Iraqi dictator mutated the language of a coup into a rhetorical charm offensive aimed at inflaming Iraqi patriotism.
When he took to the Iraqi people, he always addresses it, you know, the great people of Iraq, the great country, which is the message is clear that you are great because of me. I made you great.
And Razak says that for many Iraqis, that message resonated.
It's just like a seed growing in the right, you know, fertile soil. So I would say, you know, it two-way equation between those who are in power and people.
The right fertile soil. The authoritarian is the choking weed, but his rule blooms in the right soil. That soil is the minds, values, and tendencies of the people. And then what becomes of that weed as it spreads and suffocates truth, reason, and fellowship needed to preserve an open society? Well, Razak says Saddam Hussein salted the soil of the Iraqi psyche with fear.
The imperialism, foreign interferes, the communist, the Islamist, you name it. It's a very dangerous because it has very long-term damage. He made us live in fear of one another.
In March 2003, of course, the United States invaded Iraq and deposed Saddam Hussein. The justification was weapons of mass destruction. One of the goals, though, was to free Iraqis from Hussein's authoritarian rule, to spread democracy. Well, Abdul Razak al-Sayyidi immigrated to the United States in 2007. He is a researcher and fellow with the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative and an expert on Iraq for Physicians for Human Rights. And he says, of course, America is not Iraq. But he also says that now, in 2020, he can't help but wonder, that authoritarian seed, that fertile soil, is it here too?
Now we are moving to, you know, there's, you know, racism, there's intolerance. If you are against me, that means you are against the country. So I never thought that, you know, that would happen. But now, you know, I really see that might happen.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today on Point, this is what we're going to talk about and to explore. The soil in which authoritarianism takes root. How fertile is that soil right here in the United States? Well, joining us from Baltimore, Maryland, is Matthew McWilliams. He's the author of On Fascism, 12 Lessons from American History. He's also a visiting research associate at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Professor McWilliams, welcome to On Point.
Well, hello, and thank you very much for having me on at this critical juncture in American history.
How fertile is the soil of American democracy to authoritarianism?
It's very fertile, and much more so than I think we all assume. Using public opinion data to understand authoritarianism and quantify it in the United States, you know, we find that about 18% of Americans are highly disposed to authoritarianism. That doesn't mean they're activated, but they're highly disposed. And there's another 23% or so who are just one step below them on the authoritarian scale. So we have this 40% or so of Americans who can be activated by the sweet nothings of an authoritarian leader.
Mm, okay, so let's try to understand that number, that 40%. So first of all, some definitions, Matthew. When we say authoritarianism in the American context, how are you defining that?
Well, authoritarians will choose authority, obedience, and uniformity over freedom, independence, and diversity. And so if you're looking at asking a question like, are you more likely to agree that our country should be governed by a strong leader who doesn't have to bother with Congress or elections, which is a polling questions that's asked across the country, across the world, actually, on the World Values Survey, you'll find that authoritarians are much more likely to agree that now the country should be governed by a strong leader, and that leader shouldn't bother with Congress or elections.
So you actually have been surveying people, right, for the past many years, and you asked, I believe, four specific questions?
Yes, it started out at four questions. And since 1992, social scientists in this country have asked these four questions. They're child-rearing questions. So we're not asking someone, are you an authoritarian or not, or how authoritarian are you? We're asking child-rearing questions. And there are four of them. Which qualities are more important for a child to have? Respect for elders or independence, self-reliance or obedience, good manners or curiosity, being considerate or being well-behaved. And this produces a scale called the authoritarian scale. And what it is, there's no way to really see it. It's a latent variable. There's no way to really see it. But what it does is very predictive of behaviors and attitudes that we would describe as authoritarian, wanting the strong leader, being afraid of diversity, the whole notion of uniformity and that there's a dangerous other out there is very predictive of that. What I've added to the scale through work in Europe is one other question, and it's the groupiness question. And that is an agree or disagree. Some groups are simply inferior to others. And when we add this question in onto the scale, it makes the scale even more predictive in terms of authoritarianism.
So let me just underscore something here. That first group of questions, those four questions about child rearing,
yes,
which have been asked for, as you're saying, many, many years, that is fascinating. So you're saying that the values that people possess regarding how they think children should be raised, about behavior, curiosity, manners, obedience, that there is a strong correlation between that and their authoritarian leanings or their acceptance of authoritarian governance?
Yeah, and their policy preferences. And their disposition to authoritarianism, how likely they can be active to take or support authoritarian policies. And really what we're looking at is that it's in their entire worldview. They view the world differently than those who don't answer in the authoritarian way on these questions.
So let me just jump in here. For the sake of sort of rigorous analysis here, Is there any other way to read that data, to read those numbers? Because I'm thinking, maybe I'm just looking at this through the eyes of a parent. I get it that how you think you want to raise your child is a profound indicator of your values. Absolutely.
Right.
And at the same time, could those manners, obedience, behavior factors be interpreted as, well, here's what I think is needed to be a good citizen in a democracy? It's good to have good manners. It's good to follow the law.
Yeah, it's not deterministic,
okay,
but it is probabilistic. And actually, I score kind of high on the scale. But it is probabilistic, which means when you take that the variable that comes out of that statistically, and you put it in the model, and you look at different questions that are really querying authoritarianism and authoritarian attitudes, the people who score high on the scale are much more likely to support the authoritarian policy position or policy preference.
And so then this is why those additional questions you were asking about diversity folded in really provide a deeper picture.
Yeah, the within the scale, the four-question scale, which has been used since 1992, but was really developed, beginning to be developed by the Frankfurt School in 1931 in Germany. But something that was missing there, and Karen Stenner, who wrote a wonderful book, Authoritarian Dynamic, pointed that out, and that was the whole notion of groupiness, in-group, out-group, groupiness. Mm. And we see that the us versus them is a large part of the authoritarian leader way of defining us versus them. And so I experimented with several different questions, and the inferior questions, some groups are just inferior to others, really helped build the predictability of the scale.
So just to underscore, you said that you found through your research that roughly 40% of Americans favor authority, obedience, and uniformity as you've defined them here. But Matthew, I mean, authoritarianism in America, in your own words, in your writing, was supposed to have been an oxymoron. Like, it was not, yeah. It's not supposed to have been here. As I point out, we fought world wars in opposition to authoritarianism. We started with this Iraq example, and I know people are absolutely, many people listening probably right now are like rejecting even the thinnest line of connection between those two examples. Is it an oxymoron in America to even ask about the potential of authoritarianism?
No, the potential's there, and it's been with us forever. And even Madison, you know, go back to Madison, Federalist 63. He knew, you know, the Federalist Papers were written in support of ratifying the U.S. Constitution. And Federalist 63, he talks about the infection of the violent passions stoked by the artful misrepresentations of self-interested men. Those violent passions are authoritarian passions. They're the desire for authority, obedience, and uniformity. And they're what Eric Fromm talked about in Escape from Freedom, being willing to sacrifice liberty for security of the strong man.
We are talking this hour, we're exploring authoritarian leanings amongst the American people themselves, ourselves. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are exploring authoritarianism, or the leanings toward authoritarianism, not just in government or the United States government specifically, but in the American people themselves, or ourselves, as I'll say. I'm joined today by Matthew McWilliams. He's author of On Fascism, 12 Lessons from American History. He's also visiting research associate at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And Matthew, I just want to play a couple of little bits of tape here from average Americans. First of all, this is 2016, a CNN voter roundtable. And voter Michael Opitz said this about what he thinks American voters were looking for then.
Donald Trump is a manifestation of the concern, and in some cases, fear of the American people, that we need strong leadership.
So that's 2016. Across this summer, we here on this program received calls from listeners who were desiring a very strong federal response to the protests that we saw in cities across the United States. For example, here is listener Anna Ferris from Sarasota, Florida.
I want to say about the deployment of the feds, I believe it's necessary. Do you see the broken windows of the businesses? These people are not peaceful protesters. Please quit defending them. It is wrong.
So Matthew McWilliams, what do you hear in those voices calling for strength and security?
Oh, I hear fear. And it's... Now, we've had an instigator in chief that's been fanning the flames of fear in this country and making us all afraid of our fellow Americans. I mean, violence should never is never an answer. But we're so much more likely now to look at a fellow American, even, you know, my neighbor who might be more authoritarian than I am, and look at them and be afraid of them. And democracy cannot survive in that environment. We have to have civil society and an open society and the ability to debate with each other and share our differences and discuss our differences. But when fear reigns, fear is the tool of the authoritarian. It's the tool to build and galvanize power. You know, someone to fear is a threat. Something to fix to remove the threat, someone to blame for not fixing the threat, a group to identify with and a group against, and those against are people who are un-American, who are actually American citizens. And then finally, the sort of the ultimate, someone who will do what's necessary to protect that group. And that's when you get into the real problem, do what's necessary. And that necessary is usually a violation of basic constitutional norms, the Fourth Amendment, freedom of speech, you name it.
Well, at the top of the show, we played that tape from Abdul Razak al-Sayyidi.
Yes.
And he literally said what you just said, that Saddam Hussein stoked fear. He said, quote, he made us live in fear of one another in Iraq. Now, you had quoted James Madison before the break, Matthew, saying that these, you know, in a sense, these tendencies are actually very human, right? It's not just Iraqi or German or American. There's a human desire for security and safety. Fear is a deep, primal emotion. And at the same time, what I wonder is that yet we are also talking about a resurgence of these leanings in an American democracy that's been existing for a couple of centuries. So this gets me to the idea of activation of authoritarianism, yes, which you talk about. What do you mean by activation?
Well, activation is when a strong man let's put it in terms of a strong man, pushes different buttons, fear buttons, to rouse up authoritarianism. It activates the reservoir of intolerance that resides across ideological and partisan divides. So we've seen that partisan divide has really been shifting. The authoritarians since 1960 have been shifting more and more into the Republican Party. There's been this worldview evolution. But it is tapping that intolerance by defining another, someone who's dangerous, and saying that saying that our traditional values are at risk. And the authoritarian uses all sorts of different tactics, disinformation, gaslighting, the cult of leadership, use of rituals. And think of in Trump's example here, the Make America Great Again, or not wearing a mask, or these chants of lock her up. But it comes down to really pitting groups against each other, dividing, which is so really un-American because the seal of our great republic is e pluribus unum. out of many, one. We're a diverse country, but we are unified. And in terms of authoritarians, you're either in or out of my group. And what authoritarians, when activated, what they want is uniformity, because that is security. They're hypervigilant. And the strongman turns on that vigilance. Mm. But, you know, there's one thing I want to be really clear about, the enemies of democracy are the self-interested and self-interested men and women who exploit the fear to expand power, mm-hmm. And their enablers. It's not people. The people in this country who have a disposition to authoritarianism, they're our neighbors. And the question is, how do we coexist in a country together and build our democracy? And what we'll find and what we know is that fear stoking, fear mongering, grievance stoking leads to division and not that e pluribus unum that we're trying to achieve.
This is such an important point. I want to spend a little time on this, because not only are we talking about our fellow Americans, our neighbors, we're talking about ourselves too. I mean, Matthew, you said a little earlier that on this authoritarian scale, you score pretty high yourself.
I'm like a 0.75, but, you know, and I feel that vigilance sometimes. I feel that need for it. But I think my upbringing was such with my, quite frankly, my grandmother and my mother, that that I can walk away from that fear.
So I want to know then, though, what is different now that's causing you to have a level of concern that maybe you didn't have when looking back at the same desires and tendencies that you said have been around in America since forever. And you even said, you know, in the 1960s, I mean, we have seen flares of othering in the United States since the nation's founding. So what is particularly different now?
You know, and in my book, I talk about many of those. None of them have gone as far as we have right now. You know, I say that Trumpism is McCarthyism on steroids. But there were times that we came very, very close to this during the Wilson administration. There was the Espionage Act, where criticism of the government became a crime. The Bureau of Investigation was clamping down on dissent and silencing protests. There was a Committee on Public Information, which was a massive propaganda machine made by Wilson. And the Attorney General at that time, Watt Gregory, I believe his name was, approved the formation of the American Protection League, American Protective League, which were 350,000 vigilantes who checked the loyalty of friends and neighbors and the loyalty of government officials. So we've had this before. We're just seeing it on steroids right now. And that's because, quite frankly, of the instigator-in-chief. He's activated authoritarians. He divides. He doesn't lessen division. He increases it. He's attacking and has attacked the ground rules of democracy. And he's eroded civil norms. Institutions have joined or been corroded by him. You know, we had two, Madison talks about two protections from the demagogue. In the Federalist Papers, he talks about in the Constitution. And one was the scope of America, the basic geographic scope. Well, now that scope is gone because we all have a town hall in our back pocket. With the digital world, there's instant communication. But also, there are no more gatekeepers. There are fewer gatekeepers in terms of information. So conspiracy theories can be stoked much more easily. And second, the Senate was supposed to serve as a check on the rise of the demagogue. The Senate was designed to do that. And obviously, the Senate did not do that and has not done that job.
Well, I want to just play a moment from the Republican National Convention, because, Matthew, you talked about the cynical men and women who are exploiting these values and fears in the American people. So here's Kimberly Guilfoyle's speech at the RNC this year.
They want to destroy this country and everything that we have fought for and hold dear. They want to steal your liberty, your freedom. They want to control what you see and think and believe so that they can control how you live.
So that was from the RNC this summer, the Republican National Convention this summer. And I also want to share this. This is an excerpt from the interview that CBS 60 Minutes, Leslie Stahl, did with President Trump last week. And she asked the president about his continuous efforts to discredit journalism.
I think I wouldn't be here if I didn't have social media. But the media is fake. And frankly, if I didn't have social media, I'd have no way of getting out my voice.
Do you know what you told me a long time ago when I asked why you keep saying fake media?
Yeah.
You said to me, I say that because I need to discredit you so that when you say negative things about me, no one will believe you.
I don't have to discredit you.
But that's what you told me.
You've discredited yourself.
Matthew McWilliams, you talked about social media, or I'd broaden it to the lack of gatekeepers in the information sphere we're all swimming through.
Yep.
So does that mean that regardless of what happens in this election, because that soil, that's the metaphor I'm carrying through here, that soil is still so ripe for authoritarianism, it doesn't even really matter that those tendencies that can be continuously activated, if not by President Trump, then by others, because of the sort of swill of information and misinformation that we're all marinated in.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of things here. Let me, first, Kimberly Guilfoyle. That is an example of Hofstadter's paranoid style of American politics. They want to destroy this country. Who's they? Anyone who doesn't agree with Kimberly Guilfoyle is they. And that was followed by, really, sort of the next step in the paranoid style, as Hofstadter would discuss it, Don Trump Jr., who said Joe Biden and the radical left are also now coming for our freedom of speech and want to bully us into submission. This language is outside of language that a democracy can tolerate. And, we have freedom of speech, right? So they can say what they want, but we as people have to say no to it. And you're absolutely right. I saw that interview with Leslie Stahl. You know, hate pays today. Conspiracy theories pay today. When Father Coughlin, he was the father of hate radio.
Mm-hmm.
He showed you the business model. But now it's gone beyond radio to the digital. And algorithm is not democracy's friend. The algorithm right now is not our friend because it takes hate and it turns it in, and it's clickbait. And, there's this great quote from Justice Louis Brandeis in 1927. It was a concurrence, a dissent, but it was styled as a concurrence in Whitney versus California. But here it is. It says, fear breeds repression. Repression breeds hate. And hate menaces stable government. That's who those who want our independence believed. Mm. But yes, win or lose, if Trump wins, quite frankly, our democracy will be hollowed out even more. Look to Viktor Orban in Hungary as an example.
Well,
but
Matthew,
if he wins,
can I just
still have a lot to do?
Yeah, I'm sorry to just jump in there on you, but I want to just explore more about the as you've been saying, othering and how central it is to this activation of authoritarianism. So if you just hang on for a second, I'm going to bring into the conversation now Larry Bartels, who joins us from Nashville, Tennessee. He's a professor of public policy and social science at Vanderbilt, co-director of the Center for Study of Democratic Institutions. Professor Bartels, welcome to you.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
So you've done a great deal of research into the forces that are driving this othering in America. What have you found?
Well, I've looked at anti-democratic sentiments in a more concrete way than political scientists sometimes have. There are these underlying personality dispositions that we've talked about that are often associated, at least in a general way, with anti-democratic attitudes of various kinds. But I think what that kind of analysis often misses is the nature of the threats that are likely to activate those dispositions in particular historical contexts. And so what I've done particularly is to look at Republicans' anti-democratic attitudes from a survey that I did back in January of this year. So there are questions like this. The traditional American way of life is disappearing so fast that we may have to use force to save it. More than half of Republicans agreed with that statement.
Larry, hang on here for a second. We've just got to take a quick break, and I want to hear more about this research and what you conclude from it in just a moment. So Larry Bartels and Matthew McWilliams are joining us today to talk about authoritarian leanings amongst the American people, amongst all of us. We'll have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are exploring authoritarian leanings, not just in the United States government, but amongst the American people themselves, amongst us, ourselves. And I'm joined today by Matthew McWilliams. He's author of On Fascism, 12 Lessons from American History. He's also visiting research associate at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Larry Bartels also joins us from Nashville. He's professor of public policy and social science at Vanderbilt, co-director of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. And Professor Bartels, you were telling us what you found about the things that drive or activate authoritarianism in America. And you talked about how a not insignificant fraction of self-identified Republicans said yes, that the American way of life is under threat, needed to be preserved by force. And what more?
There are a few other questions here. A time will come when patriotic Americans have to take the law into their own hands. More than 40% of Republicans agreed with that one. Strong leaders sometimes have to bend the rules in order to get things done. About 45% of Republicans agreed with that one. And back in January now, even before President Trump's recent harping on election fraud, there was an item saying, it is hard to trust the results of elections when so many people will vote for anyone who offers a handout. And 75% of Republicans agreed with that statement. So there's a lot of anti-democratic attitudes out there. And so I was interested in trying to figure out where they come from and related people's tendency to agree with these kinds of items to a whole range of political and social attitudes, and was struck that the factors that were most predictive were not attitudes about President Trump or partisanship, views about the Republican and Democratic Party or ideology or economic or social policy preferences, but a set of factors that I refer to as ethnic antagonism.
Ethnic antagonism. Okay. And how do you define that?
This is a range of questions that tap in various ways people's views about the social status and the political status of immigrants and African Americans and Latinos and, to a lesser extent, poor people and people on welfare. So there were questions about whether these groups get more than their fair share of government resources, about whether they have too much political influence, question about how serious it is that some people discriminate against whites, questions about the importance of speaking English for being a real American. So a whole range of attitudes that tap into a general concern about the status of these groups. And I think what this is getting at is the most important part of the social context that seems to be activating these anti-democratic sentiments currently, which is the looming threat, as many white Americans see it, of demographic change and social change in the country that's already occurred and that's projected to occur in the coming decades. I think for many people, this is really the core of the threat that they feel to their way of life, and they're increasingly agitated about it, and in many cases, at least willing to contemplate anti-democratic steps to keep things under control.
Matthew McWilliams, let me turn back to you here for a moment. Has some form of ethnic antagonism, as Professor Bartels describes it, been at the core of the rise of authoritarian governments anywhere in the world throughout history?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, it's ethnic antagonism, and looking at the other, you can just see what occurred in Europe in the last few years with the movements of Muslims north from Syria and other places into Europe, and it caused all sorts of antagonisms within different countries in the EU, and also stoked the rise of parties like the League in Italy, which is an authoritarian party. Viktor Orban used it to consolidate power. Marine Le Pen and National Rally used it as a cudgel to gain power. Even Geert Wilders in the Netherlands used, you know, I think it's 1.8% of the Netherlands is Moroccan, and he used that group as a group that was going to change the nature of the Netherlands, and he used that to run in the Dutch elections. And even as far north as in Poland, the PIS, the Law and Justice Party, which is an authoritarian party, using immigration as an ethnic antagonism as a way to hold on and consolidating parties of power.
Well, gentlemen, if you could just sit with me for a second, because I want to turn back to the thoughts of Abdul Razak al-Sayyidi. He's with Physicians for Human Rights, fellow at the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. We heard from him at the very top of the show because he was born in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, grew up in Iraq, moved to the United States in 2007, and he shared with us the similarities that he sees now in the United States and his experience growing up in Iraq. He also talked to us, though, about the strengths, the really powerful strengths he sees in the United States' fundamental democracy. And here's what he said.
I think we are powerful in the United States because we are diverse. We come from different backgrounds, and each one add value. Each one, you know, we learn from each other. That's a positive. That's power. But if you look at it, no, you're different from me. You have different color. You have different religion. You have different background. You have different culture. Then I should fear you. You come here to, I don't know, to kill me or to steal me or to, that it's a disastrous.
And Razak says he really wants to see his fellow Americans now celebrate that diversity.
I think we need to work very hard among each other in order to build the, you know, how can I say, you know, to get together, to get united, not to get united against each other, but, you know, to get united, you know, for the sake of the country, to respect each other. And also, you know, for the other generations.
And one more thing from Razak, because this is really personal to him now. His wife just gave birth to their son last week.
I want my baby living, you know, not like me. I come here to live in a free country and to be free and no more fear. I live all my life under fear. So I want my son here to never live in fear.
That's Abdul Razak Al-Sayedi. Matthew McWilliams, is there something about the ideals of American democracy that we can turn to find the solution to push back against the rise of American authoritarianism?
Yeah, it is all in our founding documents and in our aspirations to see those founding documents realized. Our aspiration towards a more perfect union, to e pluribus unum, diversity is our strength. The problem is this myth of American exceptionalism persuades us that we can't have activated authoritarians in our country. We're special. We're different. And, you know, our Constitution's an exceptional document. Our Declaration of Independence is a soaring, aspirational proclamation. But we're not exceptional people. We're just people. And it's really up to each generation of us to live up to these aspirations and to form a more perfect union. And part of that is working on our past as much as our present. We have to look at the open wounds in our nation and heal them. The systemic racism. We can't deny our past. You know, the authoritarian wants to deny the past and reshape it in their own likelihood, own image. And you have that with Trump and the 1776 Commission, state-sanctioned whitewashing of American history. We need to confront our past, slavery, racism, Chinese Exclusion Act, this dirty laundry at the bottom of our hamper, a historical hamper. We need to confront it. We need to reconcile it, and we need to speak with one voice that diversity is our strength, not uniformity. Authoritarians want uniformity.
But can I just turn back to Larry Bartels for a second? Because, Professor Bartels, is that possible? Because what you're describing with your analysis of ethnic antagonism is that that very diversity is seen as the source of the fear. That this just tribal fear that you're talking about. So I hear what Matthew McWilliams is saying. I hear it, but realistically, is that celebration, that honest reckoning, going to have any effect on the very people who are most possessed by the fear?
I'd say that tribalism is a powerful factor in politics almost everywhere and almost all times, but that the importance or the salience of this particular kind of tribalism ebbs and flows over the course of American history, certainly. I was thinking of a terrific article by Robert Putnam, whose title is E Pluribus Unum, and he documents a lot of social problems that seem to stem from diversity in America and other societies as well, but emphasizes that these seem to be mostly short-term tensions and conflicts, and that over time, the pattern at least has been that groups that are viewed as others gradually become incorporated into American society and begin to be thought of as part of America in a way that they hadn't been previously. And so it's possible to imagine that the tensions that we're experiencing now, that are in many ways reactions to social progress over the last half century, will over time ebb. In the meantime, though, I think we're in a dangerous period. And one of the things that we really don't know much about is the extent to which public opinion of the kind that we've been talking about is really fundamental in determining whether or not significant backsliding in American democracy is likely. Comparative studies of democratic backsliding tend to focus much more on the actions of political elites than on the preferences of ordinary citizens. And similarly, studies of outright breakdowns of democracy mostly emphasize the fact that they're due to the choices of political leaders rather than to the overall sentiment of the public as a whole. And so the practical political significance of these attitudes, I think, remains to be determined.
That's unsettling, to say the least. Matthew McWilliams, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, that is unsettling, but I think it's accurate. I would also, Madison, before he was president, after the Bill of Rights was passed in Congress, talked about the necessary conditions to maintain a democracy. And it's an article that's really overlooked, but it's fascinating. And three of his points were establish true political, economic, and social equality. And to maintain a democracy, we must do that. And he also had two other points. No special deals for special interests is the way I would read his other point and make one party a check on the other. But the notion that to have a strong republic and a strong democracy, you have to have political equality, you have to have equality of opportunity, and you have to have economic equality, I think is really central to how we move forward in this time, which is extremely dangerous. I think it's the most dangerous time since the Civil War.
You're talking about recasting how we talk about what self-interest is, right? Within the context of a healthy functioning democracy, that it is in every American's individual self-interest to have a democracy of political, economic, and social equality. But for as long as that is not the message that is being sent, whether from the White House or through media, how is that recasting of what self-interest going to happen, Matthew?
Yeah, it's very difficult because we have a media, and really I'm thinking more as we were talking about earlier, the digital media, where hate pays. Conspiracy theorizing pays and division pays. And so we have a communications problem. You know, we need elites who will, quite frankly, take up this cause and talk about it. And we need people to be able to listen to it and see that really the future of democracy is dependent on it. I don't have a solution for the algorithm. It's beyond my pay grade, but it is a incredible problem. When you listen, you know, I listen to a lot of people in focus groups, and they're just alternative facts are real in their minds, and they have a totally different view. And I think what we have to do is we have to come back to an agreed upon set of facts that are true. And we're so far away from that right now with the alternative sets of facts that it's just very disturbing.
Right. So this is a challenge point in American history. But I also believe that part of the solution lies at the ballot box, as it always does, and from neighbor to neighbor.
So that's neighbor to neighbor.
That's where I'm going to leave us today.
I think you're absolutely right. You're on. It's neighbors, talking to neighbors and dealing with neighbors as fellow citizens.
Well, Matthew McWilliams and Larry Bartels, thank you so much to both of you for joining us today. We have links to their work at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.